As I said, we are in the discussion questions on verse 1. We've talked about the point of view of Solomon the king in the book of Ecclesiastes, as stated very clearly in the second verse. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And pointed out that that is a mindset where God is not in the picture. And so the things that are considered, and we're actually, a good portion of our study is going to be an examination of those various aspects of life where men seek to gain value, to gain purpose in living, that if those things are without God in the picture, that they are ultimately without value. And the two that we have emphasized up to this point in lesson one is the recognition that life is more than physical existence, and if we look at life as a cycle without God in the picture, as stated in the first 11 verses of the text, that ultimately we are brought to the conclusion that life is vain, that there is no change, things are as they always have been, and the mundacity or mundaneness, excuse me, of life is something that causes an individual to be despairing is the word I'm thinking of, causes despair in a person when he realizes again that as you get along in life that the same things are happening over and over and over again, and it's the same things that happen in your parents' generation and the generation before that, and if this all is all that there is, then there's no ultimate value in anything. And that's the point that that he makes under the Roman number one. The second one is that the wise man tried wisdom. In other words, thought that perhaps in wisdom that there is value. But he came to the conclusion and understanding that that also is not the case. That for one thing, you can't know everything. And secondly, that with wisdom comes sorrow. As we learn more things and are more aware, that is something that brings sadness in our lives. And so if that's all that there is, then life is vain as well. In the third, the second lesson, which we'll get into in a few minutes' time, then we get to sensual pleasure is what's under consideration. But there were some discussion questions that we wanted to go over and at least make note of them, if they engender discussion in the class, that's fine. Some of them, they say discussion questions that are almost cut and dried as far as the answers, so they won't take as much time. Look at question number 4. Enough is never enough. A man never earns enough. A woman is never beautiful enough. Our stuff is never nice enough. Our relationships are never romantic enough. Like the cow with his head through the fence, we yearn for greener pastures. Happiness comes when we step off that treadmill and declare enough. I am satisfied with my life. So looking at the text in Philippians chapter 4, and someone might want to read that to me, Philippians chapter 4 and verses 11 and 12. Read that for the class. Would you read Philippians 4, 11 through 12? What life secret did Paul declare in that text? Would you read it for us, please?
Not that I speak in regard to me, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need.
Okay, so what is the life lesson he learned there? Do what?
Be content.
Be content, okay. What is indicated where he indicated that he had learned how to live with abundance and how to live in with want or suffering want? Is there a trick to learn how to live with when you don't have it much?
God is the only thing I know.
Well,
if our mind is on material things, that's kind of hard to do. I don't know how you learned.
Kind of be satisfied with what you got.
Yeah. Well, that's the important lesson, and it is a. But let me ask this question, just because it's interesting. point of discussion is who has the most difficult time being content, the individual who is living with very little or the individual who has anything that he wants? I did that guy heard four
anything
things.
Anything that you want, I think.
You think so? Yeah. So the rich man has a harder time being content than the poor man?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think they always want more.
I think both of them have their problems. A poor man can be envious when he sees what others have. He can be resentful and angry that he's struggling to get by day by day. But at the same time, a poor man has experienced life without abundance and knows that the days progress and you get by day without that. And that perhaps it... joy can be found in small things, and that's something that a rich man would have a hard time learning. The rich man, the idea of contentment, has to find contentment in something else. The rich man who has sought riches, because not everyone really seeks riches, so some people are just blessed. I mean, they are successful at what they do, but they're individuals that get rich because that's what's most important to them. And those individuals are the ones that have a lot of problems with contentment because they go into it with the idea that if I get this, I'm going to be happy. If I obtain this, that's going to fulfill me or in some way. And when they get it, then they realize that that's not made them happy. It's not filled the life. So the next point that they have, if they have that mindset, is then it must be that contentment comes at the next level. So I've got to get more than what I have now, and they're always pursuing that. And it's almost it's like a lesson that is old in time. But each individual has to come to the point where they have that eureka moment where they finally recognize that material things not what it's all about, and what I need to do is be happy where I am, and and that ability to be content with what you have is something that is a difficult trick for us to master, but it's something that the Apostle Paul certainly did, because when he wrote that, as we've noted, he was actually in prison and in fear actually for his life, and yet he was content in his place because he understood it's not about things. And so that's a good secret, life secret, that we need to establish for ourselves. All right, questions, comments about that? Okay, next question then is number 5. Laugh and the world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. And he says, sadly, the opposite may be true, as there seems to be more sadness than happiness. So the idea he has there is that cry and the world cries with you. Laugh and you laugh alone. That's not what I got out of that old saying. I thought it meant everybody loves someone who's cheerful, but if you're unhappy, then nobody's going to want to be around you. He seems to think that means that there are more happy people than there are sad people, and that's not the case in our society. But regardless of the legitimacy of that phrase in this illustration, the point that he makes is that there seems to be an awful lot of sadness today. And that certainly is the case. We mentioned in the prayer all that's been going on with regard to both man-made and natural disasters. And there is a lot of angst and sadness in the world today. It's the way it is. So the question is, in what way should God's people be different?
If you're content, you're joyful. Or I say joyful, you're happy.
There is something that is very fulfilling to not be always lusting after things that you do not have and trying to. In other words, you're at peace. The peace and contentment is something that allows a person to be happy. I don't think contentment and happiness is the same thing, but when you have a content person, he's more likely to be a happy person than someone who's... I mean, you think about it, the Apostle Paul, how often he used the word rejoice and how often he expressed pleasure, primarily in the actions of the Philippian brethren in the letter that he wrote to the church of Philippi, because they had sent those things to him, and he was happy about their relationship, about their faithfulness, about what they had done for him, and this was despite the outward circumstances of his life. So the small things that he came across allowed him to be happy, because otherwise his life, in his eyes, was okay. And I think there's something to be said for that, because an individual who's not happy with where his life is, he's wanting something he hasn't gotten yet and striving to attain it, he'll pass by a lot of things that could make you happy, and it won't touch him because he's focused on the, what he doesn't have. And so contentment leads to happiness. That's a certainly a good point. I took this a little bit different, and now that I see what we're talking about, I think I probably took it a different way. But there's a legitimate point, or an incorrect way, but there's a legitimate point to be made as well in that idea that crying, you cry alone, that I wanted to note as well. And because I think it does directly impact our ability to be happy. When we are crying, when we are suffering, there is a tendency on our part, I think, to seek solitude, and understandably so. But there is also a sense often that we have that we're isolated. I'm struggling, I'm sad, something's happened to me, and I'm by myself, and no one understands, or no one sees it, or no one cares. And if we can be, as God's people, mindful of the needs of others, mindful of what other people are going through, and mindful not in the sense that we're just aware of it, but we are aware, and because of that awareness, we want to do what we can to help, that's something that can be very beneficial to everyone's mindset. And I'm reminded of the text in 1 Corinthians 12. You may be remembering that particular passage where he talked about various parts of the body, and the statement that he makes in verse 26, that if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. And I think that's the imperative of love that we find as we seek to live for Christ, especially the phileo love, the brotherly affection that we have as a result of our relationship as Christians. And I just wish that we would be more mindful of one another's needs and be aware of it and help when we can, because that will help everyone to be content. It will help everyone to be happy. And in our day and time, there's certainly a need for that. There's like a lot of people that are suffering for one reason or another. A practical application of that is that, just to be mindful of this, that when someone makes us aware of it or a circumstance arises, we're quick with the sympathy and the expressions of sympathy, but perhaps a bit too quick after the expressions of that sympathy to go on our way. And while it makes a person feel better to know that they're loved, again, continued acts of kindness and awareness of their plight is something that's beneficial. So just a couple of things to think about that really aren't central to this question, but brought it to my mind at least. Yes, Patsy.
Yeah. Considering that it was talking about there's more sadness, and in what way should we be different, Paul taught us that we are the light of the world and we should shine. All through Philippians, it's about joy, and that's what we should be busy expressing.
Very good.
And when we're having to comfort somebody, we need to not just be silly joyful and say, well, you know, you'll get over this and you'll be happy again. It's a matter of telling people why you're joyful. You'll find comfort in God. Things like that. But we should not be going around being sad and upset all the time.
Good. I preached on that Sunday night, the joy of serving the Lord. And that's something that's true for us as Christians. But I mean, what we're doing is something that is valuable. It's right, and there is contentment to be found in that. There's joy to be found in worshiping God. There's joy to be found in fellowship that we have with Christians. Joy to be had in shining as an example. So all of those are points made in the lesson, I think, legitimate in this regard. It would be. If the world is, and I know that our light shines only so far, you know, the ones that are around us, but in the midst of all the despair that we see in the world today and the unhappiness, we can almost be a beacon, because, wow, you know, that person is different. That person radiates that joy often or always. And so I want to know what he's got or she's got that I don't. And sometimes it's by our example that we bring others to Christ more than what we have to say. And so that's something to be mindful of. Okay, question number six there. Two words were written on the wall of a college classroom. Apathy rules. And what is the description that Solomon used to describe that same mindset in chapter 1, verse 2?
All is
fine. Yeah, see, these are the questions, really not a discussion question. Did I tell you the soap bubble story that I came across with regard to this phrase? It's been a number of years ago. Most of you probably have heard of this, but a number of years ago, I found a paraphrase of the Bible, basically an attempt to put the Bible in modern colloquial English. And it was a bit flippant. There were certain parts about it I really didn't like. They renamed Peter Rocky because the name Peter is a rock, so they named him Rocky instead of Peter, and other things like that. So this is ridiculous. But I turned over to Ecclesiastes 1 and Eric 1:2, and it said, soap bubbles, all are soap bubbles. And I thought, okay, well, that's not what I would. What I've translated it as, but the concept is true, because what he's saying is, what Solomon's saying is that there seems to be substance and value there, but when you grasp it, it's not there. So the phrase that's used, of course, in the scripture is grasping for the wind. It seems to have substance, but you can't grab hold of it. And so the same thing with soap bubbles. All you think of a small child or a pet or something, you're blowing bubbles and they're reaching for it, trying to grab it, and they can't. That's the idea of life that is lived without response to God. And again, this statement question number six, apathy rules. That's a contradiction in term. Because it's something that's said with verb, and apathy is the opposite of it. This statement of vanity of vanities, all is vanity, he expressed in another place is Solomon sighing. It's a verbal sigh. It's just like, what's the use? What's the use? And so there is apathy in that kind of a mindset. Okay, question number seven. Without God, what's the answer to the question of verse 3? What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? None. Very good. Okay, question number 8. What illustrations are given in verses 6, 7, 8, and then 9 through 10 of the same old, same old? I guess the way you put it earlier in the book. Let's see. Verse 6, we've got the cyclic nature of the wind. Verse 7, we have the evaporation and precipitation cycle that we find in weather. Verse 8 is the fact that one generation after another has to work and is not satisfied with what they receive. Verse 9, everything is the same as it always has been. Nothing new under the sun. And I think it's also in verse 10. See, this is new. It has already been in ancient times before us. Anybody get anything beyond that? That's definitely good illustrations of the fact nothing changes. And then question number 9, if the wise man was frustrated at being able to learn it all, what is the message for us?
Look at things above.
Okay. So, if you want the good life, you have to look elsewhere. Look at things above. Yeah, that's the one. And again, in addition to that, if he didn't learn it all, he's the wise man, then we aren't going to learn it either. So value is not found. Ultimate value is not found in seeking wisdom. All right, so again, trying to get through those fairly quickly. Anybody have any questions, comments about any of the discussion questions in lesson one? Let us then go to chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, and also the second lesson in the book on page 6. Chapter 2's the playboy who would be king. So you look at chapter 2 and verse 1, the statement, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also is vanity. So there is the premise of the second chapter. We're going to try certain things. Enjoy yourself. Get all you can out of life. And he also indicated that was vain or futile in pursuit. Let's look at all of the examples that he gives here. And to start off, you'll notice in this little paragraph that begins the lesson, he talked about how interesting Solomon was, because under his leadership, there was a lot of prosperity. That's one of the blessings you remember God gave him. But what happens in times of prosperity? It's been said by some individuals that one of the things that United States could probably benefit would be from a good old depression. I had a little discussion with Brother Foster before he passed a number of years ago about that saying, about what some people would say about that, and he was adamant that you don't want to have a depression. he lived through it, and so he understood how difficult it was during that time, during the Great Depression. But at the same time, when you look at the cycle in Israel, it was during time of want and difficulty that the nation turned to God again and again and again. In fact, one of the reasons, I think, for the judgments that were visited upon Israel was to bring them to repentance. And one of the ways that God used to accomplish that was to bring physical calamity upon the nation so that they would turn to Him. And conversely, any time that you see Israel in a state where they are without need, they are blessed, they prosper, there was always that tendency of the nation to either feel themselves to be self-sufficient or even to go to other gods. And that's a peculiar thing, but it happened time and again. And it happened with this wise man Solomon, who had asked God for wisdom. God had given him wisdom, but also prosperity. The word Solomon, somewhere else they say, it comes from the Hebrew word, and you've heard this, shalom, which means peace. So his name was from that etymology, and certainly it characterized his reign. So here he was basically at peace and prosperous, and so just like the foolish rich man of Jesus' parable, who said, I have goods laid up for many years, so take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. That's what Solomon did. And so in doing that, and there's nothing wrong, intrinsically wrong, with enjoying the bounty that God blesses you with, to enjoy prosperity. But when, again, he left God out of the picture, that's where the problem came. And that's, I think, what we have in our society today to a very great extent. We have a very prosperous society. The things that we have today, other generations and certainly other nations have not had. And yet there is that tendency to focus on those things rather than God. As a society, it's certainly the case. As Christians, we have to be careful to not be influenced unduly by the same thing. So, take your easy drink and be merry, Luke 12:19. So that yearning of peace. Now, notice in the second paragraph, there at the bottom of the page, he said he tried finding life under the sun to be monotonous, boring, knowledge unfulfilling. He turned to sensual satisfaction. That's what we're talking about here, sensual satisfaction. He notes, first of all, what happened when David did the same. The unbridled lust of David as he saw Bathsheba. And, of course, that led to adultery. It led to conspiracy to murder. And so David, when he looked that direction, it caused him problems as well. So you'd think that the wise man would think about that, but he didn't. In fact, he mentions here he didn't look at his father and learn from his father. He didn't ask God. He didn't receive counsel from trusted advisors. Throwing caution to the wind, he dove in simply because he could. I wanted to just note those three things. That is, it's not as applicable to this group, but the importance of looking to how your parents handle things. there is something to be said for what is referred to, I think, as experiential wisdom. That is wisdom gained by experience. This is what has happened to me. I have learned from this. There is much more value to be found in learning from the mistakes of others, because then you don't suffer the consequences that they suffered when they made the mistake. That's a more difficult way to learn, though. You tell your child, don't touch the burner on the stove. If you do, you'll be burned. And if he's interested, you could tell him about how many times other people have been burned when they have done something like that, and how bad it feels to get burned. You may even have your own specific examples of times when you got burned because you did something foolish. But still, that child is going to have a tendency to try it himself, or to maybe it's different for me. And I think that while you think that to be foolish for a small child, don't do that. That's going to hurt. You'll fall down. You're going to hurt yourself, but they do it anyway, and sure enough, that's what happens. Actually, that's something characteristic of older people as well. We make those same kinds of mistakes. And so we can, I think, learn a great deal from inquiring. And he mentions learning from your parents. He mentions learning from God. And he mentions learning from the counsel of trusted advisors. Now, this is something that I try to tell young people to do. And this is something that I've seen quite often in religious matters. When a young person is struggling with some aspect of their faith, or struggling with the doubts that they have, the tendency almost always is for them to turn away from God's people. Instead of going to God's people and say, I'm struggling with this, what would you do, or how would you help me, or what advice would you have? There may be a sense of shame there. There may be a desire not to let people know about your struggles as a result of that. But whatever reason, too often, instead of turning to the individuals who can help them, they instead turn to the individuals that are the source of the problem. And so the problem is exacerbated, the problem becomes greater because of who they go to for counsel. You think about Rehoboam, as he became king of Israel and the people asked him to lower the taxes. It seems to me, when you look at that story, that Rehoboam didn't want to lower the taxes. So he asked the older, wiser advisors. They say, that's a good idea, and they'll follow you to the ends of the earth if you do it. But his own friends said, no, make it worse, make it harder. Show yourself to be a strong king. And he did what he wanted to do. But he was bolstered by the advice that he was given by the foolish. And too often, I think that's what Solomon did. He did what he wanted to do. And it's always possible, if you want to do something, to find someone who will tell you, yeah, that's the right thing to do. And it may be, for young people, it may be them saying, your parents don't understand, or what they are their, you know, they their generation doesn't get it. It may be a worldly friend who doesn't understand why it is that you've been living a life of self-denial anyway. Whatever the case may be, you'll find someone who will say, it's not a problem, what's the big deal, or yeah, go for it. And so you do what you want to do, and that's a problem, always a problem. And I think that's exactly what Solomon did in all these examples that he came up with. So, questions before we get into the examples that are found on page 7.
Why is that?
Yes.
Why is that true? It seems like you always go the opposite.
Well, again, I think that it's because of the willfulness in our heart. Yeah, we want to do it.
That's like one rotten apple in a bushel.
Eventually, yeah. And again, I mean, there is a deceitfulness to sin. Which is why the devil takes so many in with it. In other words, sin looks to be enjoyable. And we'll talk a lot about that in these examples that are given of individuals who looked at it and thought, this is something to be desired. And yet when they tried it, it led to all types of problems. But people wouldn't sin if sin wasn't fun. And ultimately, or initially it is. Now, ultimately, again and again and again, it causes problems and it causes heartache. But on the surface, when a person drinks a lot, chemicals hit his brain, he loses inhibitions, he has fun. Next morning's a different story, but he has fun. If you persist in that because he likes that high, then he loses his job, loses his family, loses his health. That's kind of the same thing with regard to drug use. When a man is enticed by a woman who is not his wife's, there's something dangerous about that, something appealing, something attractive about it. And again, it leads to destruction. But there is that appeal that is there, which is what leads him astray. And so all of those kinds of things are characteristic of people. A man is drawn away by his own lusts and enticed. And when that lust is acted upon, it brings forth sin. And sin, ultimately, when it comes to full fruition, brings forth death. And so it starts off fun, but in the end it's destructive. But again, when you hear about teenagers, and this is something about teenagers that's interesting, because you consider them somewhat mature in the sense that they've, okay, now, you know, it's one thing when you're learning how to talk and you're toddling around, but now you're 16, 17 years old. But they say that it's not until the late teens or early 20s that impulse control is something that biologically is easily mastered. In other words, there are biological things that keep a teenager from always acting in his own best interests. That impulse control is something that is developed late in life. Now, I mean, it seems like the science is pretty settled on that, and anecdotally you can see it, because you have teenagers that know that what they're going to do is going to get them into trouble, and they do it anyway. And the unfortunate thing is, because of the way our society is set up today, that those kinds of issues can lead to a destroyed life before you ever get out of your 20s or out of your teens. You can already run into problems that are going to follow you through the rest of your life. And ultimately, that's what we're talking about, is impulse control, resisting temptation. And that's harder for young people, certainly. But it always looks good. You just have to resist what the enticement is, so that you aren't led to ruin. And that's something that Solomon, of course, didn't do a good job with regard to what he tried. Again, keep in mind, he dove in simply because he could. I think it's a pretty good description, bottom of page 6. So, what did he try? He puts this under the major point, dust in the wind. And so kind of keep that in mind, the dissimulation, the lack of substance. This is a good description of this section. Starting off, he tried pleasure. And so, what do we mean by pleasure? I think all of these are somewhat subcategories of that. I want to enjoy myself, so I'm going to try. But let's talk about pleasure generally. What Solomon had is his position as king. He had all the money that he wanted. He had all the authority that he wanted. In other words, he was accountable to no one other than himself. No one's going to tell him, you can't do that, because he was the king, so he could do what he wanted. There are a lot of people, again, who are in that same position. How many young people will tell their parents, I cannot wait until I'm out of this house, because then I can do what I want? That's it in a nutshell. I don't want to be accountable to you. I want to be accountable, in fact, to no one. Now, I think we all kind of have limits to one extent or another. But if you talk about a lawbreaker, a criminal, the criminal wants to do what he wants to do. He doesn't want to be accountable to the laws of the land. He doesn't want to heed them. He wants to do what he wants to do. So that application is something that is problematic again and again and again. I want to do what I want to do. And that's what Solomon did. And he puts it here. It says, take a drive down Pleasure Road, unknown to Solomon, those like him today. It's a dead end. I tell you what, this Wilson Adams got a way with the phrases, doesn't he? So I've heard that in his lessons he does an awful lot of illustrations, these kinds of things, in his preaching too. But that's a good point to be made. So look at this statement number one. It said, we're spared the details, as Solomon only gives the results. So we don't know exactly everything, the details of everything he tried and how each thing ended up, but he says it's all vain. And this is an application he makes here. The purveyors of porn don't tell you that. And so there we have that, is that pornography, of course, is prevalent in our society. It's easy to find on the internet. There is softer versions on it that we can see on the television, on the networks, on weeknights these days. And so, you know, sex sells is what they say. And so it's everywhere. But the emptiness of that pursuit. The up-and-coming businessman dumps his wife and kids for the married secretary. He discovers this truth. That is, it's a dead-end road too late. The wife who flirts on the internet because she enjoys the thrill of being wanted will think differently when she wallows in the shame of losing her husband's trust. So the examples that he gave has reference to sexual pleasure, but we could, of course, make that more broadly applied, and I think does in these specifics as they finish. But here, the phrase at the end of number two, learn on my dime, that's what we were talking about earlier. Trying to get the wisdom from him so that we don't make the same mistakes that he made. So pleasure in general there. But let's look at some specifics. Letter B, laughter, first of all. And when I have to admit to the fact, and this is why I don't like very many movies. There are two kinds of movies that I like, adventure movies and comedies. I don't like drama. The reason I don't like drama is because I don't like to go to a movie to cry. I know a lot of people like that and enjoy that, but it's not a pleasant thing for me. So I just as soon not have the emotional jerking around that would lead to... it's a cathartic experience, I recognize that, but it's not something I enjoy. So I gravitate toward adventure, you know, those kinds of movies or comedies. You can't find a comedy these days that's worth watching. They're all profane. Again, sex sales, so that's the reference to that. But there are an awful lot of people that, you know, they live to laugh or live to cause others to laugh. I thought one of the most poignant ends of a life happened with regard to Robin Williams. Here's a man that most would say, and if you've seen any clean routines that he does, is extremely funny. People say that he's probably the most funny individual of our generation. But he was sad. He was manic depressive. He was always on drugs, trying to keep an even keel. He was a miserable individual, and he committed suicide as a result of it. So the sad clown, you hear that. The Italian clown Panini, I believe his name was. Did I tell you all that story? Because I've read it a number of times. Recently, there was a man that went to a psychologist, and he's talking about how depressed he was. And so the psychologist told him, well, go to this performance of Panini. He's the greatest clown in the world, and he'll make you laugh. And he said, I am Panini. You know, in other words, so I think there's something to be said for that. Laughter is madness. He states in verse 2 of the text, I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? How does it mean, what is it meant by that, that it's madness? Laughter is madness. Anybody have any idea? Yeah, you know, I've tried to understand that, and I really think in looking at that phrase, it's not a literal statement that if you laugh you're insane, but it's an indication of what laughter can be perceived as. Have you ever seen someone who's actually gotten so tickled that they couldn't control themselves? There's a little bit manic and crazy about it. You know, you can. I remember. Now this may make you think that I think I'm funny, but my friend and I in high school, we were in a talent show, and we did the Who's On First, Abbott Costello. We did a pretty good job of it, so we really put a lot of effort into it and tried to do it. But we were, you know, we were amateurs, so it wasn't nearly as good as them. But we had a guy, one of the performances, I think there were three performances, and one guy like on the second row of seats that got so tickled, maybe the first time he ever heard the routine, but his laughter was actually disruptive to our attempts to get through with the routine and all. And it was just like I couldn't figure out. I'm thinking in my mind as we're going through this, is he making fun of us? Is he, you know, like laughing real hard, like this isn't really funny, and he's just being being that way. But turned out, I found out who it was afterwards, and we talked a little bit about it. He said, that is the funniest thing I ever heard. He just got so tickled he couldn't stop. So he was just, out of control laughter. He couldn't control himself. And so you think about that when you consider someone. If you ever see someone laughing like that, and you don't have any idea the why of it, there's a little bit something crazy. So I think maybe that's kind of what he's looking on, because ultimately he says of mirth, what does it accomplish? Now, he's not saying here that a good sense of humor or the cathartic nature of enjoying yourself and of finding something funny is something that's inappropriate. But again, when we're talking about living for that, that's why I just want to be happy. I want to laugh. That's what life's all about. There are some people who have that view, and that's just not right. So that's one thing. Maybe one of the minor things, but it is definitely one thing. It's good to enjoy yourself. I mentioned this as a part of this class, maybe as we read these things a little bit at the beginning of the introduction. But I've got a video of my wife who was attacked by a bird that was in our house that's just hilarious. And we all felt better after we were out of control in our laughter watching that video and when it actually happened. So it can be something that helps lift the spirits. But someone who's thinking that life is all about the way to get the most out of life is to look for reasons to just be laughing, that's where the value is, and certainly is not there. What about wine? He tried wine. Verse 3, search my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, until I might see what is good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. Wine. The interesting thing about wine, this is just, I guess, an aspect of our society, but more than other kinds of drink, there's a snobbishness and a sophistication to wine. I mean, for example, there's a study of wine. An individual who does that is called an oenologist. And that's taken from the Greek oinos. And I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but sommelier, which is a wine steward. You go to a fancy restaurant, and the guy with the tux comes out. That's what he's called. It's French. It's spelled S-O-M-M-E-L-L-I-E-R. I tried to look up the pronunciation, so I don't know French, but that's kind of what it looked like. But the idea that he knows everything about what wine goes with what meat or what meal and how the wine should be chilled or that it should be served, it's kind of like the way you guys are with coffee. I don't understand it. My wife, she I don't know how many times she goes up to McDonald's because that's what we're on a trip, and that's the only place we can go to get coffee. Do you have fresh coffee? Coffee has to be fresh, number one. It has to be a certain temperature, number two. It has to be a certain strength, number three. It has to be a certain kind of creamer. And she carries the creamer in her purse. So when I say all you, I mean my wife. This is what I'm talking about. So she's an expert on coffee, at least the way she likes it, and that kind of thing. But there's with wine, there's this kind of, if you're not, if you don't do that, people go on wine tasting trips and by the way, that's kind of what he's talking about here. He's not talking about drunk. So when he said I searched my heart out to gratify my flesh with wine, didn't mean I got drunk every night. It meant that again he was pursuing something, hoping to find value in something. So the sophistication, the connoisseur of liquid delights here. Maybe we can find something, and there are people who do that. That's what they're interested in. It's a hobby of theirs. They collect them. They try them. They read about them. Those kinds of things. That's something obviously that is vain. Maybe most of us get that. Although my wife again with the coffee, I don't drink coffee by the way, which is why I'm that way. Okay, so anybody want a comment question about the first couple, left or wine? I don't want to spend a great deal of time on any of these, but they're all worth at least acknowledging because I think we all, or at least some, have a problem with just about each one of these, even in the church. The next one might describe us, elegant houses. And I could be happy if I just had a house. Debbie was watching a sappy movie on Hallmark Channel that she had recorded on the Hallmark Channel. And the guy was about to leave, and she was going to let him go. And then, you know, late at the very end, they got together, and she went with him. So that's what it was. And the little tagline to the end of the show, and I wasn't watching, I was doing my work, but I heard it. But the tagline was, I found that home is not a place, it's a person. Okay, so, but that's there's something to be learned from that, because people have the idea, you know, I've got a home now in this house. It's a maybe a monstrosity with what it's got and the size of it and such, but this is something that's going to make me happy. Verse 4 of the text, make my works great. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. Planted all kinds of fruit trees and made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. Boy, he was really having a nice place, thinking that maybe there was some value there. Now again, with all of these kinds of things, there's nothing necessarily intrinsically wrong. Now, I would say with the wine, I've got a problem with it intrinsically, but having a nice house, deciding that you enjoy gardening, which again, if you do that, I don't understand you, but that's you, and that's fine. The worst chore for me, period, is mowing the lawn, but that's the way I feel about it. So, but again, if that's what it's about, and people dedicate their entire lives to those kinds of things, and that's the most important thing in their life, and that's making sense. But again, look, think about that, because I do want to say, okay, you know, if you're not Niels Berry, you know, then you're okay there. And that's not true either, because these can displace the Lord as first in your life. You can still go to church, but you're thinking about these things, and you're interested in these things more than you are the Lord. And I think with all of these, it's not an all or nothing with any of them. It's just a matter of what becomes most important to you, what interests you most. And so what I get in mind is, okay, let's say the gardening. So I buy Niels Berry's book, and I love to read Niels Berry's book, and I read all about the various kinds of plants and how to care for the plants and fertilizers to use for the plants, and that my dusty old Bible sitting over here in the corner and never gets looked at. So that's kind of what we're talking about with regard to it. We're missing the point as to what's most important. All right? Questions, comments about elegant houses? Then we get into letter E. He tried servants. And again, I don't know that there is as much application here, but he does make the point that he was looking, or that in obtaining at least male and female slaves and homeborn slaves, that allowed him to be at ease. And so he says, maybe I need more servants to wait on me as I wine and dine in my mansion overlooking my gardens and parks. And the point is that what happens when you have nothing to do, you get bored, which can lead to other problems as well. But thinking that there's value. I don't know why people think that there's going to be value to be found just sitting and looking at what other people have done for you. But that's there are a lot of rich people that feel that way, certainly.
I see him as not having a purpose in life. Just sitting back and doing nothing. That's like he had no purpose to get up in the morning or do anything.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing, because isn't the letter or the book of Ecclesiastes his search for a purpose? You know, he's trying to find a purpose, and so what he's actually doing is just kind of aimlessly blundering about because he doesn't have a purpose and he's looking for something. And I think there's a good point there. So you know, possessions and the servants, those kinds of things are an example of it. Possessions is the next one, which I think is tied in. I mean, male and female slaves, those are possessions as well, but again, I want all the stuff there is to have. And you know, men like man caves, and And that's going to make me happy if I've got a place where I've got this, 60-inch TV, and I've got all the gaming systems that I want, and I've got the pool table and all those kinds of things. Then I'm going to be happy. The interesting thing, and again, my dad didn't have that value by any means, but we did have a pool table when I was young. And shortly after Mom and Dad started attending services again and we moved to our new house, we had a two-car garage. And I've never talked to Mom and Dad about that as to how this came about, whether she was on board with it or not. But we got a pool table. And the interesting thing about that pool table is how much fun it was initially and how little use it got later on. So after a while, it was just this big old thing sitting in the middle of our den for years and years, and didn't get played on too much. Whenever I had friends come over, we'd play. Oh, this is great, but it was fine for a little while. And I think that's what we are with our toys. Men are especially bad about this. Men and their toys is that you get it and it's fun for a while, and then you go on to something else. And again, the idea of getting satisfaction, ultimate satisfaction in things, some people do, but a lot of people don't. In other words, some people get hooked on it, put it that way, they're addicted and stick with it, but a lot of people don't.
It's Jerry
walking around. So, possessions. If I own more stuff than anyone else, then I would be happy or gain value in life or feel fulfilled. And that was vain as well. Next was an interesting one, collection. Anybody here have collections? Okay.
I just moved. My kids learned don't collect.
Okay. All right. So, different times in your life, you come to awareness of maybe there was not necessarily misspent. If it gives you some enjoyment, then that's fine. But not a lot of value to it. Yeah. I've been talking about my dad some, but this one thing, he did have certain collections from things that he liked to collect. It's always been something interesting to him. If anybody's interested, we have hundreds of mixtapes that talking about cassette tapes, audio tapes that you can have if you want them from my dad. That he spent hours and hours and hours doing because he enjoyed it. And this kind of goes to the point where what happens to those who come after him? What will they do with it? Because he's no longer here, and we still have the tapes, and nobody wants them. And in fact, I remember when Mom got to the point where she's ready to clean out some of those things, that there were tons and tons of DVDs, and he liked it. It wasn't so much as buying them; he liked buying bargains, so he enjoyed getting bargains and all, and get in. He'd watch them, and he thought maybe we would want them, and nobody did. And so we sent them to Half Price Books. Got about a tenth of the value of them to go on. So
we had reel to reel tapes.
Reel to reel, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fortunately it's now digital, so you don't have to have it. But people still have it. Their iTunes collection on iTunes. Emily, do you have an iTunes account? No, you don't. Good for you. I don't either. I don't like iTunes. But I do have some digital songs. I do have some. So anyway, collect baseball cards, comic books, knives, stamps, others, dolls, or shoes. What did Solomon collect? He collected silver and gold. Notice verse 8a, I gathered to myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces, acquired male and female singers, the delights of the son of men, musical instruments of all kind. I think that the latter part is under the letter H. But the collections. Said that 1 Kings chapter 10 and verse 27, can you imagine this? So much silver became as common as stones in Jerusalem. Wow. that's a lot. But the collection, what good did it do? There was no value to counting and viewing his collection. Some people enjoy those kinds of things. And again, that's not the point. The point is making that the be-all and end-all of your life. Some people do that as well. Entertainment. That's even private performances from the singers wasn't something that had any ultimate satisfaction. A lot of people live to be entertained. That's why a lot of people go in debt with all of the cable and the packages, the value packages you add to it, and all the other services, and going out to movies and those kinds of things. Can you imagine, though, the king with those private. I remember reading about Elvis. He was such a famous individual that whenever he went out to a movie, he had to rent the whole theater, or else he'd be mobbed. So can you see this? Can you imagine the sadness of that? Is sitting alone. I mean, he had probably two or three people with him, or how many ever he wanted to bring along. But sitting there and this having that kind of a life, and how sad it must have been to be that kind of individual. Maybe Solomon had some of those things. He's trying to fill that emptiness. And then letter I, and this is the last one we'll talk about today as we go through that list, and that is women. And men do that, and women do that to men as well. And unfortunately, in our society today, there's even men to men and women to women. But Solomon, in his case, verse 8c, that's not 8c. Well, how do you get that from 8c? Unless it's the delights of the sons of men. But in that regard, as we have revealed to us with the concubines and the wives, he had a thousand women available day or night, ready to fulfill whatever fantasy that he had. And he was bored, as indicated in verses 9 to 11. Reading verses 9 to 11 of chapter 2. I became great, excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this is my reward for my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, all the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. I want you to notice what is said in the latter part, or middle part of verse 10. He said, I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this is rewarded my labor. In other words, I'm going to get, you know, it's a sense of accomplishment. I'm going to get these things, and I'm going to enjoy these things because I deserve these things. It's kind of the attitude. So there is some indication. I wanted to bring this up because of the idea that we had earlier of how sinful actions can have that surface appeal. You know, I want this. I'm going to enjoy this, and for the moment, I do enjoy it. What he's doing is looking at it at the end. So he says, yeah, I got everything, I tried everything, I enjoyed myself fully, but when it comes to the end, it's vanity. And that's the final lesson that he learns there. Unfortunately, too many of us have not reached that end where we come out the other side and saw that was not worth it. And again, this is perhaps more a problem for the young than it is with those who are older, who've learned those life lessons. Who all need to learn it, is that ultimately trying to live to get, enjoy, to do as much as you can, and that's what life is all about. It's not. And you have an awful lot of people, they go in different directions to get it, but they all come to that final understanding. All is vanity and striving after the wind. Now, if you'll look at number 3 at the end of this, under point I, letter I, number 3. Close friends, a loving spouse, family relationships, a warm home, unselfish generosity, and a heart for God, then the hope of heaven. These are the things that make life worth living. I love that as a counterpoint to the things that we've talked about today. And I've made the point, I may have already made it in this class, so if I've repeated myself, I'm sorry. But this is something that I find always at the end of life. Whenever I preach funerals, I attend funerals, I talk with a family that has lost someone. They don't talk about their collections. They don't talk about the entertainment that they involved themselves in. They don't talk about all of the possessions. What they talk about is the family. And if they're a Christian, they talk about their faith. Faith and family, faith and family, faith and family. Those are the most important things, always. And that's where the value of life is. And the thing is, I have several individuals in mind where I'm thinking of when I think of this, who lived their life in pursuit of these kinds of things, often to the neglect of family. And and certainly the neglect of faith. And I've had to be in living rooms of those families at the death of that loved one. And there's a wistfulness there. They wish that they would have had more time with. They wish that they would have been closer. They look back with fondness on those few crumbs that they had, that they could think. And, you know, there was this one time when he was there with us and we had such a good time or whatever. And he was a very busy man, or she was so interested in on these other pursuits, but there was this time, and I loved her because, or him because of this, that, or the other. But there's a wistfulness there. I wish it would have been different. And I've even sat in hospital rooms and individuals who are near death and talk about the regrets. And that is, I spent so much time in this pursuit when I should have been with my family. I should have been serving God. And that's what my regret is. And that's what Solomon's trying to get us to do, is learn from his mistakes so that we don't reach that point in our lives where we think, man, I just spent all of my time grasping for the wind, and I could have been doing it differently. Good lessons to learn. All right, so we will. Anybody have any questions, comments about what we're talking about?
I think that if you've ever been in that position in your life where you realize how hard it is to get out of that situation that you've gotten into, you know, it gives a little bit more compassion on people who do leave their faith or who do get in these situations in trying to help them.
Yeah.
Because it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Anytime you have someone struggling with this, that's a universal
regardless
problem.
Regardless of the situation and who it applies to or whatever, it can be that.
It's kind of Jesus saying that he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy for us to be judgmental of others who are struggling with some aspect of their faith. But I think all of us have from time to time, so we need to be compassionate. Appreciate very much everyone's time today. We'll pick up with point number, whatever point number that was.
Three.
Yeah, point number two. The bottom page eight, three comparisons.
Okay.
That's it. Point number two, three comparisons.
Right.
Thank y'all for coming today.
Thank you.